Welcome to Write Through the Roof, the podcast for writers who want to improve their craft. I'm Madeline D'Est, and in this show, I'm interviewing writers of all different types and asking, what's that one thing that took your writing to the next level? So come and join me and learn all the proven tips, tricks, and techniques to take your writing right through the roof. The Flower and the Serpent, a new novel by Madeline D'Est. Modern-day Shakespeare meets supernatural mystery with this nail-biting young adult horror. Available on the 4th of December 2019 at Amazon. The Flower and the Serpent by Madeline D'Est. Hello and welcome to Right Through the Roof. I'm Madeline D'Est. Today I'm speaking with Alison Littlewood. Hi, Ali. How's it going?
Hello, Madeline. Yeah, really good, thank you.
Excellent. A little introduction about Alison Littlewood. She is an award-winning horror and dark fantasy writer who lives in a creaking house with crooked walls in South Yorkshire. In 2014, she won the Shirley Jackson Award for Short Fiction, and she's the author of 8 novels, including her latest, The Ghost Story Mistletoe. Thanks again for sparing a few moments and avoiding your walking of the dogs to come have a chat with me.
A great pleasure. Thank you for having me along.
Excellent. So how I like to start is, you know, warm up a bit. We don't need to go into the big questions straight away. So a few short, sharp questions to get you limbered up. Now, the kind of boring question that everyone asks, but, you know, you have to ask it. Are you a plotter or a pantser?
Do you know, it's funny because I'm a little bit of both, so kind of failing at the first question there, so I tend to kind of plot beginnings and endings and pants it all the rest of the way.
Okay, yeah, a lot of people seem to do that. So what happens though midstream if you get a better idea?
Hopefully it happens in such a way that I can go with it, and I think that's lovely when that happens. It certainly happened with The Hidden People, where I got halfway through the book and realised that there were going to be whole other layers of things going on in the little village that I created, and characters kind of took over. And it's great when that happens. I think when readers say to me, oh, that part of that book really surprised me, quite often it's because it really surprised me too. So I think not kind of plotting out everything to the nth degree does enable that little bit of flexibility for hopefully something to surprise everybody, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you write every day?
No, I'm a bad person, Madeline. No. I know that's kind of the golden rule. No. I try and do something every day, whether it's editing or research, but no, I tend to find I'm a bit cyclical when it comes to getting a first draft down. So no, I'm just bad.
So you don't have like a weekly word count or anything like that? Is it?
Actually, I do try and keep a word count spreadsheet, particularly if I'm trying to first draft a novel. And I don't necessarily stick to it every day, but I tend to use it as a guide just to keep me generally on track. And hopefully try and just chase ahead of it a little bit, ideally. Sometimes I'm kind of bang on with it, and sometimes it's just a stick to beat myself with. But either way, it's kind of useful to do that.
So I was wondering, some of the plotters that I've spoken to have got like hardcore spreadsheets to plot out their novels, but you've got the spreadsheet to tally up your word count.
Yeah, I have, and just to beat myself over the head with, really.
what's your target usually?
I keep it actually pretty small, and like 1,000 words a day. But I tend to find that with other things that are going on, and I've got quite a lot of projects that I'm editing at the moment as well. That it's just a kind of general thing to keep me on track. If I'm literally just spending a month first drafting a novel, I'd expect more of that from myself, really.
And a kind of sneaky question before, are you like a careful crafter or are you a vomit drafter?
a great way of putting it. Yeah, I'm a funny crafter, but a careful crafter in the edit. In fact, I'm really obsessive about edits. And, you know, I edit a lot before I even hand work in. And then, of course, a professional editor looks at it and it kind of begins again. So, yeah, I spend a lot of time on just reworking things. Because obviously, banging down a first draft quickly, it helps to get the story together and to let things happen. But it does raise its own issues in terms of, you know, I'll put things in that don't make sense and then realise that that's not going to happen. So, yeah, I sort all that out in the careful crafting afterwards.
Okay, so it sounds like you only do a couple of drafts in before it goes to the, or at least two before your editor has a look at it, yeah?
No, I'd probably do quite a lot more than that, actually, because I'll edit and then read and then edit again and read. And, yeah, so I do quite a few drafts, but I don't really keep track of how many. Mm. I suppose it depends on the project. I mean, I have some short stories that have been through countless drafts and some that somehow come out almost whole and a couple of drafts and they're ready. So it just completely depends on the project.
Mm, isn't that amazing? I was just looking at some of my own work today where there's, you know, I'm looking at certain scenes where it's just, yeah, it came out like fully baked, and others where it's like I've got to do, just go over and over and over to fix it.
Yeah, it's quite frustrating sometimes, isn't it? I had one that I've been tinkering with literally for months and it took about 6 months before I thought, oh, I'll get that one out and have another look at it, and suddenly could see what I needed to do. But yeah, it took me a long time to get there.
And do you have any writing rituals?
Not especially. What I mainly do is make sure the dogs are happy. So once I've walked them and fed them and the canine overlords are satisfied, then I'm allowed to begin. A lot of it's just basically showing up at the desk.
Mm. Yeah. So you've got Dalmatians, don't you?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Beautiful.
It's quite good because they get me out and it wakes my head up, you know, going out for a good walk early on, and yeah.
Lovely. Okay, well, it sounds like we've got to know you and your dogs a little bit more. So let's get into some more in-depth questions. So I know we had a little chat about this before we started about genres and things like that, but how do you describe your writing, and are there any particular themes you like to explore?
I generally just call it dark and weird. I'm kind of known for being a horror writer, although my work kind of become it's on the edges of horror, really, and it has drifted more towards the mainstream to the degree that my more recent books have been badged fiction. But my books do generally tend to be fairly dark, with at least a hint of the supernatural going on or something off kilter or wrong with the world. My historical ones that I've done set in Victorian times, I tend just to call historical weird. But in terms of theme, I tend to circle the unanswerable questions, so things like loss and death. But I tend to think the converse of that is that they're really about love, because unless you love something, then there's no emotional payoff in losing it. So I think generally they're just about various aspects of being human, albeit it tends to be the darker aspects. And I also love using folklore and twisted fairy tales in my work. And I think that comes from just being slightly obsessed with stories generally. So I love the idea that, you know, in folklore, there are these layers of story buried in the ground under our feet. And, you know, fairy tales, they're kind of buried away in our psyches from being small children. And I think tapping into those veins, it gives quite a rich resonance for me. So I just love working with those kinds of ideas.
Yeah, that's definitely an interest of mine. But
it's
really interesting. Horror is such, like, it's a real cliche, but horror is such a broad church. Like, there is, you know, your horror is, you know, quite different to what other people might think of in terms of horror, which would be a lot more kind of splatter, you know, a lot more gory or whatever. And you're probably more the gothic side.
Yeah, definitely with the Victorian books, a lot of people describe them as Victorian Gothic. Yeah, but as you say, I think a lot of the time a general reader will probably define the horror genre by splatter movies, and that's what they think of. And so it's quite difficult when people say, what do you write? Because you don't kind of want to give them that impression. I've actually had people, when I've said I write horror fiction, that kind of stop talking to me and back away, literally. Which is quite odd. It can be a real barrier for people.
They think you're some kind of like Clive Barker.
Yeah, well, I think they think that all horror writers are like the monster in the closet, and we're not, are we? We're like the kid cowering under the covers. And people say, oh no, but you're actually quite nice. Like, I don't know what they expected, kind of two heads and fangs or something. But it is quite funny the way that perceptions have built up around it. And a great shame. I think there's such a rich range and depth of work happening in the genre. Because as you say, I mean, I define it quite widely, and there's so much wonderful work going on. And people unfortunately miss out on that quite a bit because they just say, oh, I'm not going to read that. It's on the horror shelf.
And I think similarly, not that I've come from reading like splatter kind of stuff, but I've found that now that I realise that I like that gothic themes, etc., that it's actually bringing me out of horror and realizing how much gothic is in, as you were saying, your books have moved into the more just general fiction area, and it's like, oh, okay, yeah, it's not necessarily branded as horror, but it's got all the stuff there that I like.
Yeah, sure. And I kind of, there's a lot of books out there, I think, where people are reading what I would define as horror, but they're just not realizing it. So something like The Lovely Bones, which over here it had a cover with that was all very pastel blues, and it looked almost chick-litty, and yet it's one of the darkest, most horrific books out there, and narrated by a ghost as well. So yeah, I'd firmly say that's a horror novel by my kind of definitions. But yeah.
Okay, we could talk about that all day, so let's talk about your writing process. Okay, so the big question that I like to ask is, what's the one thing that you think has been most helpful in improving your writing?
I think the thing that springs to mind is what Stephen King said about reading a lot and writing a lot. Because I didn't start really trying to write until I was into my 30s, but I've been such an avid reader from being such a small child. I think in a way I was kind of in training for it all my life, in a way. And, you know, I've read books on technique and how to plot and things like that, but I think there's no substitute just for doing it and just to be open to learning and soaking up everything you can. But then moving along from that, I think working with editors has been one of the main things that's really helped me develop an awful lot. So right from working from people on short stories in the indie presses right through to getting the book deal and working with Joe Fletcher, you know, I don't think there's anything like where you think you're handing in a draft that you think you've honed to perfection, and then you get it back and it's absolutely covered in edits. And, it, you know, it really does teach you a lot.
And what I've found is working with the same editor over and over is that how it just picks on your little weak spots.
Yes.
Which you're supposed to learn how to stop doing, but
yeah, but somehow never quite. I'm a little bit like that with semicolons. My first drafts are absolutely littered with semicolons, and I do quite love a semicolon, but I just do need to rein it back a little bit. But probably never quite enough.
Maybe, are you like being cheeky or like rebellious, going, I'll just sneak a couple more in and see if I can get away with it?
Yeah, when you're kind of editing, you've taken loads and loads out, and then you get to a sentence and you think, you know what, I'm putting one back in. And yeah.
So you mentioned before that you're editing stories as well, so you edit as well. Do you find it interesting to kind of swap brains? Can you...
I tend to think I'm a fairly thorough editor, but the thing is that in order to really look at something objectively, I think you need quite a long gap sometimes. So if you've got the luxury of being able to put a project away for a few months and then pick it up again, that's fine. But otherwise, I think you really need a fresh pair of eyes on something at some point. So, yeah, back to the words of Stephen King, to write is human, but to edit is divine. I think, yeah, I do really value that input from people.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So are you trying anything new at the moment in your writing?
Not especially wildly new. I'm kind of keeping on keeping on, as we say in Yorkshire at the moment. I have been toying with the idea. I read a quote recently by H.P. Lovecraft that he said nobody knows whether they're a writer unless they've tried writing at night. So I've been toying with the idea of setting the alarm in the middle of the night and just making myself get up and try and write something. But, you know, so far I just prefer my sleep. So, you know, just kind of keeping on with the same techniques, really.
So sorry, Lovecraft is saying that you're not a real writer unless you write at night. That's interesting.
Yeah, quite. And I'm thinking I've got these books. I kind of hope that I'm getting somewhere by now. But yeah.
I've been writing in the sunshine.
The quote makes you think, or perhaps I haven't even started.
I've been writing in the sunshine, in the bright light. Lovecraft would never approve.
Yeah.
I suppose, well, it depends. Are you an early, because sometimes I'm an early morning writer, and that would, I imagine, feel like what it's writing at, like 2 o'clock in the morning, if it's 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, actually, I do sometimes get up and just jot notes down for things that have popped into my head in the middle of the night. But, you know, when you get up the next day and just think, what on earth were you talking about? I actually kind of worry that it would be completely mental.
Which might explain Lovecraft.
Yeah. Good point.
But, you know, in a good way.
Yeah.
So we're talking about Lovecraft, we're talking about Stephen King, we're talking about reading. So what, apart from those two, what writers, I don't know if they do even, what writers inspire you and why do they inspire you?
Well, I've been reading a lot of ghost stories lately. So, I mean, I love Michelle Paver's novels. Especially with those cold Arctic settings. I mean, I quite love a good cold setting, so... I mean, they're just right up my street. But then I've been reading some more modern ones, like Jason Arnup and the way he weaves technology into his work. So his new one, Ghoster, absolutely fantastic. So completely different from my work, but, you know, I just really love those. And people like Paul Tremblay, Joe Hill, Katrina Ward. I just read Andrew Michael Hurley's Starvaker, and oh, that's just beautiful. Loved it. Short story writers, I love Nathan Ballingrud, Priya Sharma, so many good people, Angela Slatter, so many great writers of short stories around. And I was really inspired by the late Graham Joyce as well, because I loved his novels. He wrote such beautiful characters, but also gave me some really good advice about writing and publishing when he was around, and, you know, he always struck me as a really wise person.
Yeah, Michelle Paver, I read Dark Matter probably just before Christmas, and, yeah, absolutely loved it.
Yeah, we're off on a trip to the Ice Hotel in Sweden in a week, and that's the first thing that I've packed. So I'm going to revisit that in the cold. And if I can't sleep when I'm there in my kind of survival sleeping bag on a block of ice, that's what I'm going to be reading, just to warm myself up a bit.
Yeah, it might not work. Yeah. I felt cold reading it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you were talking about ghost stories. Actually, I was waiting for you to mention M.R. James, but anyway, let's talk about Mistletoe and what inspired that, and were you trying anything different?
Do you know, I wasn't so much trying anything different with that one as tapping into that tradition of telling ghost stories at Christmas. So actually M.R. James was really at the back of my mind in that. And, you know, a lot of those Gothic writers, sometimes they even began the stories by saying, you know, everyone loves a really good spooky story at Christmas. And I just thought, a nice seasonal ghost story that harks back to Victorian times as well would just be a really lovely thing to do, to encapsulate some of my obsessions as well. So it's about love and loss, but it's also wrapped around the folklore of mistletoe and some of the legends around the plant, and around different aspects of the season. And I've gone back into the history of midwinter festivals as well and wound those things in. So yeah, history, folklore, ghosts and spooky things, really. So it brought together a lot of the things that I just really love working with.
Sounds fabulous. Sounds like all my favourite things too. So how much research do you do?
A lot of research. I think when I came up with the idea for the Hidden People, because I do tend to just follow an idea without kind of thinking through the consequences, and I just get a little bit obsessed with it and off I go and find out how to do it as I go along. But it was the first one I thought that really needs to be a historical novel, and it doubled my workload overnight. And I started to think, well, you know, how can you even write something where people are talking in a house, because unless you know what it was like to actually live in those times and every aspect of how they set up the household and domesticity. And so it wasn't even just a case of researching the big themes that were in the book. It was just kind of reading really widely and picking up on the little details. So books like How to Be a Victorian, you know, getting the basics of how people washed and dressed and things like that right, underpinned it as well. Fortunately, I got a little bit obsessed with it, so I just kind of read and read. It was kind of difficult knowing where to stop, to be honest.
Do you research along the way, or did you do all the research up front and then?
I did quite a bit up front, just because of that feeling that when I got to the keyboard, I just thought, you know, I haven't got the knowledge to kind of begin, really. So I did quite a bit up front, but then once I'd got the groundings together, then I started off and researched things that fed into the story more. So things like the Great Exhibition that was going on and some of the things that were exhibited then, the interesting details, yeah, and things like railway time from Victorian times, when, you know, you could go to a village and there might still be a clock with local time, which was taken from the sundial, essentially, as opposed to standardised railway time that people had to use to go and catch the trains by. You know, changes like that I just find fascinating, because there must have been quite a shift in the mindset at the time. Mm. Sorry, I'm kind of rambling. I do get caught up in these things.
No, that's really interesting. My brain went that way as well. So I suppose, see, historical fiction always frightens me because I'm not a historian. But with the supernatural elements on top of your stories, I don't know whether that gives you a little leeway, or have you received any letters from readers about how you got certain things wrong?
Do you know, I haven't. And the Historical Novel Society reviewed, I think it was The Crow Garden, or it might have been The Hidden People, and said that I'd done the voice really well. And, you know, there was nothing, you know, them, as much as anybody, I would expect to say, oh, well, actually, people wouldn't have done that. But no, actually not. It'll probably happen tomorrow now, but I think anybody who writes historical fiction, there's that fear that you don't know what you don't know. No, although I have become that person. If I'm reading a novel and I'm thinking you've got a séance going on in the 1840s and they didn't happen at that time, you know, I know.
The Fox sisters hadn't broken out yet.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, good. Well, I think I'll start to wrap up, and I'll let you get back to your dogs and your writing. So what are you working on at the moment, if you can tell us?
Yeah, sure. well, I'm just getting back from a slightly lazy Christmas break and getting into things, editing a novel length version of a novella that I wrote for Newcomb Press called Cottingley. So it takes a look at the Cottingley fairies, which were supposed to have been caught on camera by two girls near Bradford, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle got involved. So it's another lovely historical incident that just pinpointed kind of the nature of people's beliefs and sense of possibilities from that time. So I find it kind of fascinating. But obviously those pictures of the fairies were kind of a little girl's idea of fairies. They were quite gauzy and sweet and lovely. And I've read a lot of dark folklore about the little folk where, you know, they're just not that nice, and encounters with them can be a lot darker. So I have kind of taken the view, what if there were encounters with fairies, but they were that darker kind. And it uses changeling lore where they can steal people away and leave lookalikes in their stead, which I think is probably one of the most scary things about fairy lore, because, you know, it's that idea that somebody in your own house might not be who you think they are. And that uncertainty, I think, is just a gift for a writer of dark fiction. I'm quite obsessed with that idea. So, yeah, I'm just getting in the swing of things by editing that again.
Fantastic. Okay, so I'll wrap up now and let you get back to to working on Cottingley. So if people want to find out more about you and your work, where's the best place to find you online?
Oh, well, I have a website. It's alisonlittlewood.co.uk, where I just about keep that up to date and very occasionally do a blog on there. But I'm about on Twitter. I'm not very good at Twitter, but I'm there, and I hang out on Facebook quite a bit. So, yeah, I'm on the various, various platforms.
I'm sure you're around for Folklore Thursday. I'm sure you're there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Even I've managed to catch on to that one, yeah.
The highlight of my Twitter week.
Yeah, it is fabulous. And it's great how somebody can tweet a snippet of something on there, and you go off and research it and think, you know, there's a story in this. It's really quite inspirational.
Oh, it's amazing. I have to stop like writing down all the story ideas because I'm just never going to get to all of them. But
yeah. I've got quite a few of those in my notebook as well, yeah.
Oh, Ali, it was absolutely lovely to speak with you today. Thank you so much for sparing the time.
Thank you very much for having me along. It's been really nice.
Thanks for listening to Right Through the Roof. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe or spread the word by writing a review on your listening platform of choice. And if you'd like to get in contact with me, please go to madelinedst.com or madeline_dst on Twitter, no apostrophes. You can find the show notes for this episode on madelinedst.com under the Right Through the Roof tab. And until next time, what are you going to do to improve your writing this week?